back to the bins.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Bins. My name is Scott Gardner. I'll be your podcast host for this episode. And it is my pleasure to have on this show the hosts of the Is It Jaws podcast, where we are going to have a little bit of crossover synergy with their show and their latest episode, which was episode 211, in which the fellas, with me as a guest on their show, looked at the classic Walt Disney film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the world's first full-length animated feature. And so for this episode, we are going to look at the comic that corresponds to that. Welcome to the show, the hosts of Is It Jaws, the movie review podcast. We have Mr. Sean Whalen. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Thanks. It's great to be here today.
And we have that Paul Spataro guy that you hear all the time.
Yes, thanks for having me on your show, Scott.
Thanks for joining us. All right, so...
Now, what's the format of this show? Because I know the movie one. I don't know what goes on here.
The hell you don't. You edit the bulk of them. So for this episode, we are looking at basically the comic book adaptation of the classic film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So first I'm going to give you the technical on this, and then we'll kind of get into the nuts and bolts of the issue. But technically speaking, this is known as Four Color Comics Volume 2, Number 49, from 1944. The on-sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, is June 30th, 1944, and it sold for 10 cents. Now, right out of the gate, I'm wondering if this is the first time this story appeared. Now, this is the first time it appeared in comics, you know, comic books. But I'm wondering, is this maybe taken from like newspaper strips or something? Like, is this the first time that it was ever published? Because if so, it seems really strange to me that this is first appearing 6.5 years after the film that it's adapting. So that seems kind of strange to me. You guys have
that's a very interesting thought. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but it's a very interesting thought because, you know, at least as I understand it, the first comic books in general, you know, famous funnies and whatever, were all reprints of newspaper comic strips.
Right.
Before they
right.
started publishing original material. So I hadn't even considered the possibility that this could be an adaptation that had been going in newspapers and then they just kind of compiled it for this. And I'm trying to look at it as we're talking to see if it would make sense, but I can't really tell for certain.
I can't tell, and I'm not terribly well-versed on comic strips, but the panel layout does kind of have that feel like maybe this was re-edited into comic book form from strips. I can kind of see where maybe this would, or, you know, and it goes both ways where this could be converted into a comic strip. So that, I think that's what kind of got me thinking in that direction initially. And I completely forgot about what you said that, you know, that the earliest comics were just merely reprints of the strips. So I think there's a possibility there, but I tried to find confirmation on this. I just couldn't find anything on it. I'm not even sure, to be quite honest, that the credits that I have on this are entirely accurate because there actually was no information on this on a Mike's Amazing World, which is usually my go-to source for these things. But what I do have on this, and I think this is pretty reliable information, is that the cover on this is by Walt Kelly. And it is that Walt Kelly, the Walt Kelly that eventually would create Pogo. That comic strip character. Now, the script on this is by Merrill D. Maris, pencils by Hank Porter, and inks by Bob Grant. And yeah, none of those names really ring a bell or mean much to me. That I feel like that's fairly reliable information. And that's about all I've got as far as this. Four color comics is one of those great blind spots for me in comics. I wish I knew a little bit more about them and their history and all. It's interesting to me that while technically they all fell under the banner of four color comics, they're essentially individual issues all published under there. But still, it's interesting that there were so many diverse and often competing characters and what we call today IPs all published under one banner. Like one issue might be a Disney and then the next one's going to be like a Looney Tunes or something. And that's really interesting to me. You know, Sean, you have some information on
it? Actually, looking at this on the Wikipedia end, they reference the fact that many of the early issues from the first and even the second series were newspaper strip adaptations. They don't reference this particular story. So that doesn't mean that this one wasn't. It just doesn't name this as one of them. But they used many of the examples of, as you were saying, whether it was Disney or not Disney, a lot of them were adaptations from compilations of comic strips from the time. So it's very possible that this one was, in fact, originally at one point in time, a comic strip. Because you're certainly right. The layout of this one clearly felt a lot like it was a comic strip.
Yeah. And just the art style, you know, to my layman perspective, you know, layman as far as comic strips, it has kind of that, what I always call that Prince Valiant kind of style to it, you know, art-wise. And I think that's what kind of put me in mind of the comic strips as well. So
I looked at a site called DisneyComics.fandom.com, and they had a whole article on Del Four Color Comics. And really more what this article is, it is a listing of all of the Disney-related Del Four Color Comics. Because this series was from 1939 to 1962, if you count Series 1 and Series 2. And it has a distinction of running for more than 1,000 issues. And actually, as of the time of the publication of this article, I'd have to take a look at where the issue numbering are right now. But because this was released multiple issues of this series each month, it actually is the longest or running or, you know, the most issues of an American comic book series, beating out Action and Detective Comics.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, that blows my mind. I guess I just naturally assumed that nothing was really toppling those two, but it says a lot about what was created here. It's an interesting sort of series because this is actually the second appearance of the Seven Dwarfs in Four Color Comics. In issue number 19, it was Thumper meets the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, right.
First appearance of them. So this is obviously we're covering the adaptation and the additional story that happens to be contained within. But this series actually has such a rich history with Disney content. I'm just surprised I didn't know about this. I'm a big fan of Disney and the comic strips in general, but I didn't know that Del Four. I don't know why this just hasn't been on my radar.
My first thought when I was looking at this is the problem is I was looking at it through 2024 eyes with Disney being this financial juggernaut that just swallows other media companies. So I started thinking, well, Del Four Color Comics must be like a subdivision, you know, of Disney, you know, a fully owned subsidiary or something. And then I, you know, like the more I thought about it, I was like, well, no, when this first came out, you know, Disney was still fighting for its financial life when Snow White came out. So they were probably more than happy to license out things and see, you know, what they could get to finance other projects. And then I look at this and the other thing about it, and to, you know, full disclosure, I'm working off a PDF copy of the comic. But from the cover, because it's got this gold inlay border on the left side of it, it reminds me of those hardcover books that you'd get as a kid, you know, when you were very young, that your parents would read you as...
Yeah, Little Golden
Books.
I'm sorry,
what? Yeah.
Little Golden Books.
Little Golden Books,
yeah. So it doesn't even look like a comic book to me when I first look at it. You know, like if it was, you know, a hardcover, there's no question. That's exactly what I would think it was. And then I don't want to go too deep into the book itself because we're not there yet, but there's, and to me, there's an absolute charm to the way this is presented, just the artwork and everything, because it's not the cheap way out where they could have just taken some stills from the movie and put them in there. You know, I mean, it's animated. Why not? You know, but that really would have been the cheap way out. Whereas this feels like they sat and they drew it all out and they recreated it. And it's, again, it's got a charm to it that I think it would lose if they did it, if this had just been a picture book from the movie.
Right. Oh, I totally agree. That was one of the reasons that I really wanted to cover it, was I just, from the moment I discovered it, I was just really struck by the quality of it. So on that subject, because I just want to make sure to throw the story out there, is I discovered this in the weirdest way. So when I first started working at Walt Disney World way back in 2010, it was at the tail end of when they used to have something called cast resource centers, and they were all over Walt Disney World property, you know, back in backstage areas. And they were literally what they sound like. They were basically libraries, but just for the use of cast members. And when I discovered one that we had where I was working at the time, it was, you know, very conveniently located, basically in a place that I had to go to every day. So it was easy to drop by, and it was just so incredible, the resources that they had there. They had a full library of books, some very rare, some very hard to find, out of print, that sort of thing, that went way back. They had an entire library of DVDs, many of which were you could only find there because they were rare, like filmed interviews with like classic Disney legends and Imagineers and things like that. Again, many of which were not public. The only way to view them was to go to this resource center. Well, not long after I started with the company for reasons I still don't know, they eliminated all of the cast resource centers, and I have no idea where the resources went. I don't know if they went into a vault or a warehouse. I don't know if they sold them on eBay. I don't know if they had a yard sale. I don't know what happened to all this stuff. But anyway, one day when I was in the resource center and just kind of poking around, the word comics just happened to catch my eye on the spine of a book, and I pull it out, and it was called, let me see, I had it pulled up here a second ago. It's called Disney Comics, The Classics Collection. Beautiful hardbound book. And the cover of it is a frame, or a panel rather, of Snow White from this issue. Anyway, I pulled it off the shelf, you know, beautiful hardcover book. And reprinted in there are basically the classic adaptations of many of the earliest Disney films, like Snow White and Pinocchio, and I forget what other ones are in there. And this issue in total is reprinted in there, including the backup story that's in this issue. And just thumbing through it, I was like, oh my God, this is gorgeous. And so, because I was just so taken with it, I hunted it up on eBay and found it was like dirt cheap to acquire a copy. So I did. And I've just always really liked it ever since, just kind of chancing across it without really knowing too much about it. And it wasn't until deciding, you know, we wanted to cover this story as part of, you know, our look at Snow White, that I did a little bit of homework to find, okay, where does this come from? And what is, you know, and finding out it was reprinted from 4Color and all that. So that was kind of, you know, the beginnings of my interest and fascination with this. But, you know, this kind of comic and especially 4Color is not really my normal jam with comics. So I feel a little ignorant going into this episode just because I don't know as much about the history on this one as I wish I did.
What, the book that you were paging through, do you happen to know if the issues at least you were looking at initially were all from 4Color, or were they from other sources?
If I had to guess, I would say they're probably all from 4Color, but I haven't researched that. Actually, let me see if I can find my copy real quick.
And while Scott does that, I'm sorry, what?
I'd just be intrigued to know if, like, he was asking the question earlier if this was the first adaptation of it. And if that collection encapsulates other things, then perhaps we might have our answer. Because you would think if they were capturing more than 4Color in there, why would they omit another Snow White adaptation that came before it?
Right.
Trying to find clues.
Right. Unfortunately, it must be in a long box. And so I can't get to it at the moment. I thought it was on my shelf, but it must be in a box somewhere that I'd have to hunt harder for. But I do remember that Pinocchio.
So it is in a comic book sized format as far as putting it in a long box.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a hardcover, you know, akin to, a modern trade or that sort of thing.
Cool.
Yeah, according to the CLZ app, it was published. The thing lost my place on this. It was published, I think it said 2006. Let's see here. Yeah, October 2006. But yeah, that's all the information it gives on it.
Okay, I have a page here. I just did a quick search. I'm going to put it in our chat, which I'm sure is fascinating to anybody who's listening, but I'll describe it once you guys have a chance to see what I'm sending you. I did a quick search for Snow White newspaper strip, and it brought me to a page called Filmic Light. And it has a 1937-1938 Hank Porter comic strip distributed by King Features Syndicate. This Snow White Sunday newspaper comic strip ran for 20 weeks from December 12th, 1937 to April 24th, 1938. It actually began 9 days prior to the film's colossal premiere at the Cathay Circle Theater on December 21st, 1937, and a whopping month and a half or more before the movie's general public release in February 1938. By the time the film actually appeared in theaters, devoted readers would have already been familiar with the Princess, Prince, and Queen. They'd also have had a silhouetted glimpse of the dwarfs marching home from their diamond mine. And it prints some pages from the strip, which are clearly the same as what's in this comic.
What a stunning preservation.
That's awesome. You know, I've often heard Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the film, called the Star Wars of its day. Yeah. This, with the strip and the comic, parallels that with Marvel Comics and when Star Wars came out in the comics, basically preceding the movie to generate hype and everything. That's really interesting. That's something I never knew. And yes, the website finally pulled up for me and looking at this. Yeah, it's clearly taken from the comics or from the strips. I mean,
so what's interesting to me, because when I've seen newspaper adaptations of comic strips before, it's usually a little bit more complex than this. This appears to just take the Sunday strips and fit them to the page and put them in. But most of the times when I've read a continuing story in the newspaper, which would be when there was a Spider-Man strip in the 70s, Dick Tracy, even the regular comic strip of Annie was interesting to read because it was always, you know, there was always some sort of excitement going on in that. But what would happen is there would be a Sunday full page or half page strip. And then during the week, each day, there would be a slight progression. And I mean slight, but there would be five strips during the week that bridged between the Sunday strips, or six, actually, I guess six, which this doesn't seem to have those. And I, according to what I just read, I don't think those actually existed. I don't think there was a daily strip. I think it was a weekly Sunday strip. But I find that interesting just from my own perspective when I used to you know, read these comics. And I used to, you know, when I was a young kid, I used to love reading the comic strips. And, you know, there were the Hagar the Horribles of the world, which just gave you a joke every week, every day. But then the ones that had a continuing narrative, I used to find fascinating. I used to really enjoy those.
The only, off the top of my head, the only one I ever read that was a continuing narrative was Star Wars. And so, you know, I don't really have familiarity with the ones that were continuing. I remember them being in the paper, like the Phantom and Brenda Starr and stuff like that. But I always skipped past them because I hadn't been reading them, and I never seemed to find a spot where I could conveniently just jump in and be able to follow the thing. So I never did.
And then, you know, I mean, I just, you know, thinking back to it and thinking, you know, yeah, I'd read like Little Orphan Annie, and you'd think, well, Little Orphan Annie, what the hell are you reading Little Orphan Annie for? But those actually were very good strips, because she had certain characters who were like bodyguards to her. I think one was called the Asp, and then another one, I can't even remember what his name was, but the, you know, these two like big muscle guys, and she'd get herself into all sorts of trouble, and then they would have to rescue her. And it was, you know, it was fun to read. It was not, you know, necessarily like a strip made for a little girl. I think it was made for everybody. And I used to enjoy reading them. You know, we used to have the paper delivered to the house on a daily basis. So, you know, before I became a sports fan, that was probably the biggest thing that I would look at in the newspaper. And then when I became a sports fan, I started reading from the back page forward.
We had two local papers. We had the Lake County News Herald, and we had the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And both of them had different comic strips in them. Lake County's had its own, like, separate booklet. Like, the newspaper strips actually came in a booklet, which was really kind of cool. And some of the newspaper strips were reprints of, you know, ongoing stories. Like, that was my exposure to, like, Flash Gordon, for example, and stuff like that, which I loved the ongoings. To Scott's point, it was always, like, it took me sometimes, especially if I was jumping in partway through the story, it took me, like, depending if it was a weekly or a daily one, it sometimes took me 2 or 3 weeks before I'm like, okay, I kind of understand the story now. And I've kind of been put into a place. But I love serialized stories. This is a great way, you think back in the day, this is a great way to lead into and get people excited for a movie. But also to maximize the experience, because you figure, you know, you do this for a couple of weeks, and if you're lucky enough to go and see the film, because I would imagine a lot of these were sellouts.
It was
hard to get into. You know, we're very used to now the multiplexes and the ease of getting into films. That was not a thing then. So, you know, it may have taken people many weeks to actually be able to get into a movie. I'd actually be curious to see what that looked like. But there's a lot of things we take for granted in our accessibility to be able to watch a movie day and date of its release now. Whereas even when I was younger, that wasn't a thing. You missed movies a lot of times. I remember going to see E.T. and like we were shut out. Right. Star Wars too.
Yeah, it was different from, you know, nowadays when you order the tickets before you go.
Yeah.
You know, you reserve your seat. I mean, that was totally unheard of back in the days of the Blockbuster, where the line would actually go around the block and you were hoping that there'd still be seats left. And if there was, say, you know, I remember, you know, like I'd go to the movies with my mom and dad, and, you know, we'd be hoping there were 3 seats together if, you know, even if we were towards the end. So, you know, it was very different. Now, what I'm finding interesting looking at this, assuming that the PDF we're looking at and the reprints of the comic pages on this website are fairly true to the way they appeared, the comic book coloring looks to be much brighter than the comic strip.
Yeah.
And I think that could just be a byproduct of the printing methods at the time. But I look at the comic strip with the more, and I hate to use the word muddy, but the more, you know, muted color. And to me, it looks superior. And I don't know if it's because of a nostalgic feeling that it gives, or if it's just that it almost has like the scenes with the queen, you know, made up as the old hag. they have a little bit more of a dark noirish feeling to them, and I just think it's very, very cool. I think the artwork stands out more in the reproduction comic strip than in the reproduction comic book.
I agree, and a part of the thing with that too is that I noticed that the colors used in the strip are generally, not always, but generally much more faithful to the, well, to a point. It's funny because up until, and I'm going to assume that that, you know, anyone listening to this is fairly familiar with the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So up until the point that she falls asleep in the dwarf's cottage, her dress is not colored accurately. But then when the dwarves come in and wake her, from that point on through the rest of the story, it's movie accurate, as it looks on a quick glance like it is for the dwarves and the old hag, and the queen looks like she's right from the beginning of this story. Whereas it is not like that at all in the reprint comic. The colors are all over the place, and I don't, on a quick glance, I don't think anybody is movie accurate in their coloring, which is very odd. So it's like whoever colored this just didn't bother to look at the film, or maybe hadn't seen it in a long time, or didn't care or something. But yeah, it's just really odd. But it also makes it interesting in that regard, because I feel like the Evil Queen's look in the beginning of the story is actually pretty cool. It's very different from the movie, but it has kind of a, with the crown and the high collar and just the evil look on her face, it has almost like a satanic type of, I mean, she's, it really plays up her as an evil figure. She looks devilish or demonic, if you know what I mean, as opposed to the royal purple that the movie had her colored as, and the strip.
It's not an easy feat that you have to make her someone who's beautiful, because that's part of the story, and yet evil and dislikable.
Right.
You know, and if you look as she's drawn, her features are, you know, she has classic features, so you could see the beauty, but the facial expressions and the dark tones and all of that create the evil dislikableness of her. So I think it's, you know, I mean, and I think we could say the same for the movie and the comic and comic strip, that they all managed to juggle that particular need.
It does show how important it is to capture, I think, the facial quality of these characters, because you're dealing with, obviously, the amazing Disney animators. And Snow White and the Queen, both of their, I mean, it's very, very clear. You can dress them up in whatever you want. If you capture that facial, those facial features the right way, it's very clear who they are. Their personalities are there and very apparent right from the first panels. And that's the piece where it's interesting to see the play around with colors and not lose, I think, character in this, right? Because you're right. We're actually looking at now, because of being able to look at both, we're looking at two different coloring versions of some of these panels. And there's things I like more about one over the other in, you know, flip-flopping,
right?
As we're looking through it. And I actually love that. I mean, it's very cool to see just different sensibilities as far as how. I'd love to know the genesis of this. Like, why? why it wound up being this way. But both are strangely effective.
I think it might actually be a different printing process for newspapers than comic books.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that might be the difference. And, you know, think about how quickly newspapers are mass produced and out. You know, they had to wait until the last possible second before actually printing them. So I imagine the printing process is very, very fast to get them all out.
Sure.
But, you know, I don't know if that's just my own thought process or if that's reality. Looking at the artwork, is it my imagination Or does Snow White look younger in the comic adaptation and strip than she did in the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's definitely smaller, more petite. Yeah, it does make her look younger, like significantly younger. Especially the
like I'm thinking I'm looking at her here and I'm thinking 15 years old.
Which is, I think, maybe how 16. Old she's supposed to be in the movie. I believe she's supposed to be about 15, 16 years old. Whereas this, I'm thinking she looks even younger than that. And at least in some of the panels, you know, the early sequence when she's, you know, in rags and at the well and everything, she, a lot of those panels, she looks very young.
I like in that. Go ahead, Sean.
Buckethead looks younger too.
Yeah.
I mean, they did, I think proportionately, they both look appropriate together, if that makes sense.
Right.
Which was something that I appreciated. I especially with the playful scene that they have between the two of them, which that's one of the things I do like about this is the difference in scenes. I like that there's some scenes that did not, would not have appeared in the movie. I think it's a different medium. I like that they were playing around with, let's tell the same story, but make one that's more workable for how do we do the pacing of a Sunday strip versus a film. And I actually think that was something that I really enjoyed, seeing certain characters go through, be spotlighted a little bit differently. And this Buckethead sequence was one that I thought was a real cute sequence and felt very Snow White, even though it's not something that appears in the film at all.
But it also gives you a little bit of a background and appreciation for the relationship of the two of them that you don't get in the movie. In the movie, sometimes you do have to question his obsession with getting to her, and the fact that she's in love with him, because they really interacted very, very little in the movie. This at least has them exchange enough so that they be interested in each other. And, you know, if you believe, you know, the movie tropes of love at first sight and all of that, then you can go somewhere with this. And I like that in the way of background. I also like that we got a similar background with the way in the way of the Huntsman.
Yes. That was the biggest reason I wanted to cover this, was I felt that it expands on the story, but it filled in some blanks, particularly with the prince. Now, I'm very loath to criticize the film, but if I do have any criticism of it, is that if you're really paying attention to the narrative, the prince doesn't necessarily make sense in the finished film, because he pops in at the very beginning of the film when Snow White's singing at the well. They have a brief scene together in which basically she falls in love with him. And then once that scene goes dark and the scene changes, he completely disappears from the film until he reappears at the very end, where it says he's been searching for her all this time and wakes her with love's first kiss. But that's it. That's all you get. Whereas this, you get a lot more. It's like, where's he been all this time? And you find that the queen is, so for one thing, they meet in a slightly different way, because the wishing well scene is gone. Instead of, you know, wishing in the well, Snow White takes a bucket and paints a face on it and puts some rags on it and basically creates almost like a scarecrow type of thing that she calls Prince Buckethead. And while she's play acting with it, he comes in, the prince, the real prince comes in, puts the bucket on his head, and then surprises her when, you know, the Prince Buckethead, she calls him, starts talking. And that's when they are introduced and they have their first scene together and everything. Now, the queen is privy to all of this, and she overhears their conversation. And because the prince finds, he actually says that she's, how does he describe her? The fairest flower that man has ever beheld. And that makes the queen jealous. So she races to the magic mirror to ask her question again, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest one of all? And then this is where the mirror reveals for the first time that, nope, she's been upstaged. It's no longer the queen. Now it's Snow White. So she orders the guards to capture the prince. So the prince you know, if you ever wondered in the film, like, where's he been all this time? This is where he's been. He's been in the dungeon of the Queen's castle. And then from there is where she orders the huntsman to, you know, take Snow White out and murder her, essentially. So to me, this fills in a big blank of the film.
The other piece that I really liked about it is it adds a commonality to the two. They both are victims of the Queen.
Yes.
It also sets up, like, his motivation, like, what he knows more about what's happened to her. Like, he's right. Walking in with some real foreknowledge on what the Queen, because she was taunting him with what she was going to do to Snow White. I really liked some of the differences in this. I thought they were very effective storytelling.
Absolutely.
And not inconsistent with what we got. It just fleshes it out further. And that's big to me, too. Because if it contradicted the film, then I probably have a problem with it. But just fleshing out the film, you know, I mean, that's not always in comic books, but certainly when you read books, that's usually why the books are better than the movies, right? In most cases, because it gives you that background and it gives you that information that the movie can't really give you because they don't have enough time to work it all in. Now, I don't know if that's the case here. Because apparently this is 20 Sunday strips for the whole story. So it's not like they had so much room to work all this in, but they made choices as to what they were going to show you that, you know, that they didn't do in the movie. And to be fair, there's sequences in the movie that take time that are very, very brief in here, because in the movie, you know, you'll have them singing the Hi-Ho song while they're working, or you'll have them, that whole sequence where they dance with her, or the scene when, you know, when they're washing up. Those things in here, they could just do in a couple of panels when they do them, whereas in the movie, they each took a chunk of time.
They did a great job in this, too, of that forest sequence. It's one of my favorite sequences in the film, just because I appreciated the personification, like she in her mind is seeing the forest come to life, you know, the twigs and things grabbing out to her, and, you know, seeing faces in places where when it's dark, you know, see things lit up and you see things that aren't actually there. I really liked how they captured the sequence in the strip, and I mean, those Disney animators did a brilliant job with that. They came, I think, about as close as you can possibly get in this strip of capturing the tone and the feel of that,
right.
Which I think is amazing, because it is such a rich sequence in the film. To be able to capture that in a strip like this is no small feat, and it's beautiful in this.
Yeah, I agree.
Totally agree.
I was...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this is one of the reasons I really like and I miss desperately comic book adaptations of movies, because I always used to like what we always used to jokingly call the DVD extras, you know, the scenes that might have gotten snipped from the film that wound up in the comic adaptation for whatever reason. Maybe the comic was done ahead of the film. They were working off a different script than what they finally shot, you know, that sort of thing. So I love that. And I agree with Paul. I didn't, other than the Prince Buckethead sequence at the beginning, which doesn't necessarily contradict the film. It's just, it's interesting that the wishing well, you know, the singing in the well is gone and kind of replaced by this. But I didn't really notice contradictions so much as omissions. It's interesting what they kept and what they took out or just kind of skipped over, because one that really jumped out to me is that the whole Heart of a Pig sequence is entirely excised from this. So basically it seems to, at least to me, to remove a little bit of the suspense about the huntsman. Cause that's one of the things, again, from the film that's always bothered me all these years, is that you don't know the fate of the huntsman. You know, did the Queen follow through on her threat? Because she says, you know what happens if you fail me, essentially. But he doesn't murder Snow White. So what happens to him? Does he run away? Is he killed? Is he imprisoned? You just don't know. In this, there's not even the threat of it, because we don't get that scene where she finds out. We're told much later in the story when we come back to the queen, that simply that the magic mirror has told her that Snow White still lives, and then that's when she goes in and creates her potion. When she creates the potion, the discovery that there is a cure to it through Love's First Kiss is entirely excised as well. And that's interesting, because that sort of removes that element of the story, which was an interesting play as well. So it's funny the choices they made here for time or whatever.
Dopey is a character that is notably, like, he's there, but he is very much in the background, and we don't see a lot of gags, a lot of the personality of Dopey in this one. And even Grumpy's arc is a little bit truncated in this. Right. But certainly that's there. Whereas Dopey was such a pivotal character, I think, in the film. And it's not a criticism. I actually, what I find charming about this is it's got all the personality, it's got all the elements of the story that are really important to give you the complete story. But it, like your point about the, I love adaptations of movies when they do this. I feel like this is worth enjoying because of the fact that it's not a scene-by-scene adaptation. It is capturing all the right beats, while at the same time being a true, like, interpretation of the film versus having to stick beat by beat to the exact piece. Actually, I think it takes advantage of the medium in a way that sometimes they get wrong when they try to do a straight-up adaptation.
Right. I think one of the things I like about this best is that, again, in the interest of kind of filling in the gutters of the story and answering some questions, is that as the queen, now she's become the hag, she's on her way with the poison apple to go, find and tempt Snow White. She stops to taunt the locked up prince and basically gives him all the information he needs once he escapes to know where to look to find him. Basically, he fills him in on what the plan is to, kill Snow White, have her buried alive type of thing. And I think that's really neat, because that, again, fills in that portion of the story. Like, how did the prince even know about this and that sort of thing?
But it also, just from the point of this story, it gives him the impetus to be more desperate to escape at that point.
Right.
It keeps it from just being coincidental that he escapes in time to come over and, whatever. It's not that he saves her from the old hag anyway, but just the same, the timing of it at all, it gave him a reason to be desperate to get out of there. And then, and they don't just say, oh, he escaped. They actually show how he escaped, that he managed to use a stick to get a key from a sleeping guard. And then when that guard woke up, he basically... I don't know if he snapped his neck, but he might have when he closed the door on him there in that panel. but another cool sequence, I thought, that we didn't get in the movie.
I
would just to follow up, you said you're loathe to criticize the movie. I am as well. And I think, everybody's already heard our ratings on this movie and how highly we thought of it. So it's not that we're dogging the movie. It's just that we're appreciating the extra that we're getting here.
We commented too on how dark the movie was, it's something that, especially for the first kickoff movie for Walt Disney, which I think as we've all grown up with Disney, one of the things that we always think of is that's like the family friendly kind of, touchy feely kind of Disney kind of thought process. When you look back at the original film, it's got all of the warm, fuzzy characters, but man, does it go to some dark places.
Oh yeah.
And this is a great example of with this sequence with the prince, where he's in the cage and she is taunting him. She's saying, hey, the goal here, I'm not trying to kill her. I want them to think she's dead so they bury her alive.
Right. I
mean, that is a very, very dark concept.
That's very dark.
Happy Sunday. It's like...
Now go to church.
I really loved that this answered a long-standing question for me. And I can't remember if I brought this up during when we were talking about the film or not, but I have ever since I saw this as a kid, I have always wondered, was it the Queen's plan? Like, did she even consider when she was turning herself into the hag? Did she have a backup plan? Like, was she okay with just now she's a hag? Or did she plan to try to reverse herself? Or did she know that she was able to, you know, restore her beauty and her natural form? This does answer that, because as she's running away from the cottage after poisoning Snow White, it says, her evil purpose accomplished, the witch queen hurries through the forest, anxious to resume her natural form. So that was her intention all along, was to change herself back. Again, that's just one of the things that the movie never even touches on, and I just always wondered about that.
I think it in my mind, it went without saying that her ego would not have allowed her to stay in this hag form. It was probably pushing the envelope of her ego just to even take it on temporarily.
There's that, and I agree with you, but I've always had it in the back of my mind, like, she hated her so much and she was so jealous that she was willing to go to these lengths, that maybe she didn't even stop to really think, like, wait, what happens after? you know what I mean? Not thinking of, you know, of the after, she's just thinking about the immediate. You know, I'm going to take this guy's, I'm going to go do this deed, I'm going to kill her, and then my rival is dead, and not thinking beyond that. Like, oh, wait, now I'm stuck like this.
You know? That would be the Twilight Zone ending, where, you know, after she eliminates the most beautiful one in the land, she's stuck being the ugliest in the land.
Right, yeah, exactly. Now the next time she goes to the mirror, there's going to be thousands of women that the mirror's going to tell her is prettier than she is.
Now, well, I want to discuss a little bit of the backup story, but I don't want to cut off our discussion of the main story if you have any more notes on it.
You know, you bring me to a perfect segue, because that's pretty much all I had on this. I really enjoy it. I think it's beautifully, beautifully illustrated. But yeah, I mean, it's basically a truncated version, although pretty complete, of the story. That gives you some nice little, you know, DVD extras, some glimpses into things that that the film didn't show, particularly the prince. You know, if you've ever wondered about his story, it's more fully fleshed out here. Yeah, I wasn't going to cover the backup in total, but there was an interesting thing on the backup story, if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about it a little bit, because as I have said in the past, I happen to be a little bit of a tool for sequels. If there's characters that I like and there's a sequel, even if it's not up to the level of the original, usually I'm still kind of okay with it. And this kind of fits that definition to some extent. And you see the artwork takes a step down from the main feature, and the story takes a step down too. But it's a short story called The Seven Dwarfs and Dumbo. And what I like about this is it kind of gives you the sequel message from the huntsman, who is now Snow White's messenger, because I guess he has a trusted position because of what he did for her initially in not killing her. Excuse me. Anyway, he delivers a gift, which is a lantern or a lamp, and it's a magic lamp where they could make a wish. And immediately they're very thoughtful about it, because they say, well, we're not going to wish for Snow White to be back, because then that would ruin the happiness that she got with the prince. But they're lonely since she's gone. So they wish for somebody whose company they're going to enjoy as much, so that they won't be lonesome. And when they wish, they end up getting Dumbo, who comes in and has an adventure with them. And we meet the prince, the queen's evil brother, who is planning to kidnap the dwarfs one by one to get revenge for his sister. And he actually captures Dopey, but Dumbo manages to get away. And when she does, I neglected to mention, he also knocks the huntsman off of a mountain so that he's trapped on a ledge. Dumbo goes over and gets the other dwarfs, and then they manage to free Dopey and escape from the evil prince. But it leaves it wide open for sequels, because the prince, unlike the queen, does not fall off a ledge and die. Right. They leave him. He's still fully functional. So this would leave an open door to continued adventures with Dumbo and the Seven Dwarfs. Again, not quite up to the level of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but a fun little short story just the same, I thought. And much more so what I would anticipate the artwork to look like in a comic of this nature. And I that is to say a little bit more simplistic, a little bit more child-friendly. Right. Whereas the other artwork is much more sophisticated, and again, moody in places. Again, not to criticize this. This is just a short little fun feature at the end.
Dumbo,
do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Dopey riding Dumbo was a mashup I didn't know I needed. I really did enjoy that. It was, because I love Dopey. It goes back to my childhood. He was one of my favorite dwarves. And getting to see that little sequence there, it actually, as far as if you're sitting there and writing and saying, what do we need to see here? Yes, of course, we need to see Dopey on the back of the elephant. It was great.
As you say, I just find it interesting that after seeing Dumbo fly, Dopey, because he has big ears, thinks he can fly too, and actually jumps out of a window and is saved by Dumbo, by landing on Dumbo.
As kind of kiddified as this is and everything, and kind of cutesy and that sort of thing, I'm still going to add it to my headcanon, because I like finding out that the huntsman survived, because I've always wondered about that. You know, what was his fate for saving Snow White? And we see here, but he's just fine. And she gave him a special appointment, as a favor, as a thank you for sparing her life. So I like that. That was my big takeaway from this. I found that very charming. I thought that was cute. I think it's really interesting to note that as you look at the story, the next to last page, if you notice, the coloring is really funny. It has like a sepia tone to it. And then the last page has a very different kind of color. It's like it's more like stark. And that's because the next to last page is the inside back cover of the comic. And then the last page is the back cover of the comic. So they literally went all the way to the end of the comic with the story. So there were no ads.
Okay, so that explains why the inside back cover is colored differently than the rest.
Right. Yep. Isn't that wild?
Because the inside back cover, to people who don't have this in front of them, is basically all red, black, and white.
Yep.
Or orange, black, and white.
Yeah. Has a really weird look to it. Like a sepia tone type of thing or something like that. Yeah. But yeah, they literally went all the way to the back cover printing the story. That's just wild. And I think that was common for these books, if I'm not mistaken. I've seen that at least a time or two with other four colors that I've looked at.
Even this simplicity is really good. Like, I mean, the characters don't look drastically different than their cinema counterparts. So you're not like sitting there going, is that supposed to be that character? It's very, very like I'm totally drawn into the world that they're taking me through, which I think is pretty critical with stuff like this. You don't want to sit there and go, is that Doc? Is that, I mean, you want to feel without a shadow of a doubt these are familiar. They feel comfortable. I'm getting to the point of the sequel piece that, you know, Paul was talking about loving sequels. It doesn't feel like a sequel if you got to guess who they are.
Right.
And I felt like it really does the job, and in feeling like they're transporting you back. This kind of true with some of the animated sequels, though, right? You've got the originals that like have a certain quality to them, but with the Disney sequels in particular, especially the ones that were direct to like VHS and DVD back in the day when they were doing the sequels, they weren't the production quality was not as high because they had to do them a little more cost effective. So right. you're going to lose a little bit of that extra detail, a little bit of that extra flair when you're doing it that way. And I think this felt right at home there, which is something when you think about how much earlier they were doing this, we're very used to now the idea that, sure, if it's a film's a success, we're going to get some form of sequel to it. But in this, it really isn't as new a concept as we think. They were doing this all the way back then.
Right.
They were just using different medium to accomplish that same task. So that isn't something that is so revolutionary or so, you know, and I get it. It's why wouldn't you continue to draw in your audience to your world that you've crafted? And this did a nice job. It was fun.
I like that they did it here because Walt famously was not a fan of sequels. He didn't like doing sequels. But I like that we still got a sequel of sorts some way, somehow, with this, you know, in the comics. And I'm perfectly all right with that. But it's funny, you know, my big thing with this that I didn't really care for was talking Dumbo.
Yeah.
And somewhere in my collection, I have a DVD of Dumbo. I forget what year release it is, but in the special features is a behind-the-scenes look at Dumbo 2, which was in production to be one of those direct-to-video sequels. And in that, Dumbo was going to speak. And I could be very wrong about this, but this is the way I've heard the story, is that basically they had so many people write in and complain that they dropped it, and it never did see the light of day. So, but yeah, that just, I don't know, it seems very, I guess in the comics... Well, I was going to say it would make more sense for him to speak because, you know, you don't necessarily want a mute character. But then again, Dopey does not speak in this. So, I don't know. It's weird because
you also have significant interaction between Dumbo and Dopey, too. So if neither of them spoke, that would make for a tough sequence.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Without fingers, it'd be tough for Dumbo to communicate in sign language, I guess.
But, you know, I thought overall, this book, the adaptation plus the little mini sequel, I found it to be just charming. I really did. I found the artwork to be really just fun to look at, honestly. And, you know, I love when I get a comic book. I love reading comics. I always have. But I love when I get a comic book that I could just look at the artwork and say, wow, look how good they did this. And there's so many sequences in this. And then to, you know, to confirm that it was a comic strip in the Sunday papers, it fascinates me, frankly.
Yeah.
I just think it's tremendous. It's really cool.
In recent years, fun has become almost like this diminishing word, and I think we do need to take it back, because of the fact that I think part of the joy of this is that it's so fun, and you know, it's something that, am I going to pick this back up again and want to page through it and enjoy it again? Yeah, because it was fun. There's something to be said for that, and I think that's a hard emotion, I think, to capture. It's a hard feeling to capture. And I think this, all the way through it, both the main story and the backup story, I think captured that perfectly.
I agree.
Agreed. So, you know, I can dispense with my grades because I'm giving this A's all around for the whole package. I do not collect these type books, but I would love to have a copy of this in my collection.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. After reading this, I was looking around to see, like, what does this price at? Yeah, an original of it, because it's been reprinted many times, as a lot of the four colors were. But this, an original of this is, it's a pretty pricey book. But yeah, if one ever fell in my lap, I'd love to have a copy of it. Mm-hmm. I agree on the grades. I think it's wonderful. I think it's charming. I think the art is beautiful. It's it's a great book. I'd love to be able to, you know, if we're so inclined on future Disney animated movies that we look at, if there's adaptations like this of them, look at those as well, just to kind of, you know, continue the trend and see what we think on some of them.
Here's my thought on that. I don't want to make it a blanket rule that if there's an adaptation, we're going to do it. Right. I would think if there's an adaptation, we'll look it over. And if there's enough to discuss, then absolutely, I would love to dig deeper and do that. But if it's just, you know, like a pedestrian adaptation that almost feels like a money grab, then I'd rather just skip it.
I agree.
I think that, first of all, I agree with your grades. I'm in the same boat. I actually think one of the pieces that we should probably put an exclamation point on those are, we're also doing that coming off of looking at the amazing original work. So when you're comparing something like this to that level of quality and innovation, because that was something we noted when we were talking about the film, to be able to come back and look at this and still be able to give this adaptation that kind of grade says a lot, because we're not looking at this and going, geez, we just saw this amazing movie where they, you know, they were inventing new kinds of cameras and new kinds of ways of handling animation and depth to it of quality. We're coming off of that and we're going, this is great. There's something to be said for the fact that this was able to hold its own when you're comparing it with that magnum opus there. I mean, I think there's a point to that.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Again, I agree totally. So that's our look at the Snow White adaptation. If you get a chance to get a hold of this, I would definitely recommend that you check it out. If you don't, once again, you can go to filmic-light.blogspot.com and look this up. Or you could just do I think the Google search I did was just Snow White Sunday comic strip, and this managed to come up. But you can look at the beautiful artwork there, and I do think, for what it's worth, I think the artwork reproduces even better there than it did in the PDF of the comic.
Agreed.
Cool.
So thanks for doing this, guys, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.